Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, in honor of the opening of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, we hear about some Lincoln statues made entirely of sweet gum balls. We talk to the author of Weird Illinois, a collection of strange and spooky goings-on in the state. We go morel hunting, and we find out what it takes to make stage fighting look so real. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. In Singapore, the defamation lawsuit, or the threat of one, is a handy tool for politicians to use against their critics. Defamation laws in Singapore are stricter than those in the U.S., and leaders of this prosperous Asian city-state have used them against opposition figures, journalists, and now the authors of weblogs on the internet. One Singapore blogger recently faced the threat of a defamation lawsuit while living as a student in Champaign, Urbana. His story is making an impact back home. AM580's Jim Meadows reports.
Bloggers in Singapore have been writing about what some call the Acid Flask Affair. Acid Flask is Singapore native Jia Hao Chen, a graduate student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Sitting at an outdoor table in a coffee shop near campus, he hardly seems acidic at all. Chen is working towards a Ph.D. in chemical physics at the U of I and says he started his blog, Caustic Soda, nearly a year ago as an avenue for personal expression.
The first 1 or 2 months, perhaps, you know, the traffic was very low and not many people visited, I guess because not many people knew about it. But since I started writing about slightly more philosophical or more social issues, then I began to receive more traffic.
Chen preferred not to be recorded talking specifically about the statements that angered a Singaporean government official. But away from the microphone, he said postings on his blog about the Singapore Agency for Science, Technology and Research, or ASTAR, upset the agency's chairman, Philip Yeo. Chen says he criticized the agency's requirement that recipients of its scholarships maintain a 3.8 grade point average. He said that could result in students taking less challenging courses to make sure their GPA stayed high. Without giving details, Chen says the language used in the heat of the moment on his blog may have been stronger than that, whether it came from him or from others who emailed their comments. Whatever was written, it resulted in a series of letters from Mr. Yeo, threatening to take Chen to court on defamation charges. Defamation lawsuits are a frequent tactic used by Singaporean government officials against critics in the media. Sam Zarifi with the group Human Rights Watch says when Singaporean government officials charge defamation, Singaporean courts are likely to agree.
If you can conceptually visualize it, in the U.S., libel laws are drafted essentially to allow the media to function as a watchdog of government and of society. Whereas in Singapore, libel laws are drafted so as to, in fact, inhibit how much newspapers and the media can say.
For its part, ASTAR said in a news release that it recognizes the value of a diversity of views. But it says the statements in Chen's blog were defamatory and, quote, went way beyond fair comment. Chen says ASTAR has never identified specifically what on his blog was defamatory. Bloggers are the newest targets of the defamation charges made by Singaporean leaders against the media. Weblogs are a new and fast-growing phenomenon, and politicians in Singapore are just coming to grips with them. Meanwhile, their legal status is still uncertain. The newspaper Singapore Today recently quoted a local lawyer as saying a blog is the same as a printed publication, legally speaking. But University of Illinois law professor Jay Keeson is not so sure. Keeson, who teaches and writes on internet law issues, says the case law is still developing on exactly what a blog is.
Or at least what's the nature of a blog for defamation purposes. I mean, is it a printed publication? So are we operating under sort of libel rules? Are we operating under broadcast situations? Is it permanent in the same way as a printed publication is seen to be permanent? It may or may not be, depending on how well the archives are maintained and so on.
Chen, of course, is living in Champaign-Urbana, not in Singapore. Keeson says it's highly unlikely any American judge would enforce a Singapore court's ruling against Chen on a free speech issue. But Human Rights Watch's Sam Zarifi says Chen is still vulnerable to charges from his home government.
I think in Mr. Chen's case, he was probably expecting to go back to Singapore at some point. He is Singaporean, and I think he didn't want to break those ties. I think other organizations have criticized the Singaporean government, but if they don't have ties there that bind them to appear in court, they are relatively freer in saying what they do.
Chen says he didn't have the time or money to fight a legal battle. So a few weeks ago, he posted an apology to A-Star and Philip Yeoh, saying that his previous statements about them had been, quote, false and completely without foundation. Chen says the statement was dictated word for word by A-Star after they found his initial apology unsatisfactory. Everything else on Caustic Soda has been removed.
I would probably put my blog back up again, but minus the things that perhaps some people felt were offensive. I'll probably wait for at least some time before the whole issue dies down before bringing it up again.
In a May 9th news release, A-Star Chairman Yeoh says he considers the matter closed and has even invited Chen to meet him for tea later this year. Meanwhile, Abby Wright of the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists says the acid flask affair has had a ripple effect. She says as a result, Singapore poet and lawyer Gilbert Koh has shut down his blog about Singaporean politics. When contacted by email, Koh wrote back that many Singapore bloggers have posted strong criticism of A-Star's conduct in the acid flask affair, but for himself, he no longer feels secure blogging under his real name. In many ways, writes Koh, Singapore is a great little nation. Unfortunately, freedom of expression is just not one of the things we score well on. I'm Jim Meadows.
You're listening to Sidetrack. A secluded spot on the Mississippi River in North St. Louis now has a place of honor in history. On that point, 150 years ago, a group of runaway slaves made a desperate voyage across the river in search of their freedom. Last month, officials gathered there to break ground on a new memorial that will tell the story of that event. But they also have a larger vision in mind. As Kevin Laver reports, they hope the first verified underground railroad site in Missouri will help St. Louis reinvent its image as a gateway city.
When Angela Da Silva gazes out across the Mississippi, she sees a shoreline a half a mile wide and a century and a half away. When the waters reflect back in her eyes, you can almost see her great-great-grandmother Susie, the plantation slave who spent 5 starving days waiting for a boat she'd heard Abraham Lincoln himself had sent to carry her to freedom. The historian in Da Silva sees the river as her ancestors did, as both boundary and horizon.
You could see freedom. That is a place. But I could very well spend my entire life on this side of it, never being able to get there.
Da Silva is president of the St. Louis-based National Black Tourism Network and part of a team that's developing Missouri's first true underground railroad site. It's their hope that visitors who will come to this narrow floodplain down the road from a busy grain depot will be transported to a dark, quiet night 150 years ago. May 21st, 1855. 9 slaves meet at the river to board a small boat to cross over to Illinois. The vessel was too small for all of them, so 5 go out first. But Da Silva says the journey is doomed before it begins. Word has already reached the sheriff of St. Louis, who's waiting for them on the other side.
When they landed and started toward the trees is when the ambush on the Illinois side was sprung.
The 5 slaves were captured. One of them was a woman named Esther, who belonged to prominent businessman Henry Shaw, the founder of the Missouri Botanical Garden. De Silva says Esther had learned Shaw intended to sell her away from her two children, so she had decided to run.
And that night when she was recaptured, he definitely made good on his promise. He turned her over to the largest slave dealer here in St. Louis, Bernard M. Lynch. There's been no indication there in the records that Henry Shaw ever sold her children, but one has to wonder if she ever saw them again.
The memory of Esther's sacrifice and those of the other slaves will be memorialized at the Mary Meacham Freedom Crossing, named for the woman who hosted the meeting that hatched the escape plan. The site near Interstate 70 lies along the trail established by the AmeriCorps Trail Rangers Project a decade ago. Grace Hill Settlement House administers that program in St. Louis. The agency's Doug Eller says they'd already been doing a lot to restore the area, like picking up trash and planting a nursery.
And then to find an Underground Railroad site right on the trail, like just yards away from our visitor center, was just like the perfect place and the perfect thing that could happen. And it was big, big news.
Grace Hill took over logistical control of the site. After the customary series of public forums, the final design was approved last June. To capture the emotional power of the site, planners called on architect John Hole. In his Central West End studio, Hole hovers over a cardboard model. Nine tall doorways, one for each slave, stand facing the river. Stair steps lead downhill and converge on a flat stretch near the riverbank. Hole points to what will be an 8-foot wall of curved steel at the foot of the hill.
The idea of the wall being 8 feet high is that you will screen out the landscape behind you. All it will be you and the river.
The design is inspired in part by Hole's own experience. The South African émigré grew up at a time when the built environment reinforced the rule of apartheid. Hole came to the U.S. to escape that mandate. But he concedes that the design exudes a feeling of entrapment between the wall and the river, forcing you to that place in the soul where fear and hope collide.
There's still this moment which is absolutely daunting when you're standing there, the final moment of the decision. Do you get into that boat or don't you? And that's what is supposed to celebrate.
The wall will be inscribed with the names of every slave known to have lived in St. Louis. On the Illinois bank, a beacon of light will shine, symbolizing hope. There's no final cost for the project, but Hole estimates $10 million at minimum. The site promises to be a jewel in the crown of historic venues that dot St. Louis's north side. Now, officials are excited about the chance to capitalize on the city's time-honored title as the gateway to the West to showcase its story as an exit port for slaves running for their lives. Translation, more tourists with money to burn.
I have no doubt that that is going to happen sooner or later.
Sean Thomas is the executive director of the Old North St. Louis Restoration Group, which is aiding in the construction and rehab of some 100 properties in the Old North St. Louis neighborhood. He thinks the easy access from the neighborhood to the site will be a boon for new retail.
Several proposed businesses are looking at the area, including a restaurant that will actually be designed to tap into the theme of the frontier that used to be around here up until the 1800s. They know that there's a good number of tourists and visitors coming into the neighborhood as it is, and that will only increase over time.
Though it's named for Mary Meacham, the free black woman who risked jail for aiding nine runaways, project organizers affirm that the site is really about Esther, the mother who paid for her defiance by being forever separated from her children. Historian Chris Zapalak is the project's lead researcher.
This is a candle in the wind. The possibilities of freedom and the fragility of freedom, I suppose, because they had a sense that they had at least begun their journey, only to have it cut short so quickly. But it's all the more courageous in that they knew the risks.
That story from Kevin Lavery. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. With all the high-tech displays available at the recently opened Abraham Lincoln Library and Museum, one very low-tech display caught Jiffy Johnson's attention.
I had no idea there was a purpose for sweet gums like that. The only other purpose for it is to dull your lawnmower blades.
This was the reaction of many visitors to Taylorville's exhibit in downtown Springfield during the recent celebration of the opening of Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Carol Alexander, who's president of the all-volunteer Taylorville Tourism Council, explained why Taylorville residents decided to depict Abe and his family in folk art.
Taylorville cannot claim to be a debate site. It doesn't have a state house, but we have a great love of Lincoln, and we do have some Lincoln attractions, such as our original courthouse from 1839, which is open for public touring. But beyond all that, we have a population that is absolutely in love with Lincoln. And a few years ago, at our garden walk, this would have been in 2001, we decided to have what was then called a scarecrow contest. And the topic was looking for Lincoln and other famous folks. And that is where it all started, because that is where we got these fabulous creations of Lincoln out of sweet gum balls. And one thing led to another, and we have 1 million sweet gum balls that were used to create all kinds of sculptures of Lincoln wielding an axe and as a circuit rider and going to a wedding and bus and so forth. And everything you see here we call folk art, and most of what you see was created explicitly for this opening weekend by the people of Taylorville.
So you brought a bit of Taylorville right here to Springfield, yes, to share your enthusiasm. What's created the most stir?
The 1 million sweet gum ball sculptures. There are a lot of sweet gum trees in Springfield, we have learned, and everybody is used to the crunch, and they don't like it. And they come in here and in various ways say, oh, there is something you can do with these monstrous things. And people just flock around these sculptures, including that life-size Lincoln on a horse.
So you're really getting in it, in a sense, by using folk art into the essence of the Lincolns, Mary and Abraham as well. By depicting them, it's almost as though you're getting a better comprehension of the soul of these folks.
Each one of these, I think, does reflect the soul. And when you consider that no one here, except for Gary DeCourcy, is a professional artist, we have a carpet store owner. Mr. Matheny with the sweet gum balls is retired from the State Department of Transportation. The high school kids did the Lincoln there with a pizza pan for a head and steel wool for a beard. Brandon Gatton works in a foundry. He used the railroad spikes to create Lincoln's dog, Fido. Three retired coal miners made Lincoln the coal miner. So everyone here spoke with their hearts and their souls. That, I think that's why people are relating to this, because everything comes from someone's heart and someone's soul. And when you look at it, you can see it and feel it. And these figures speak to your heart and your soul. And I think that's why we have created such a stir. We just had a writer in here, a well-known writer from Washington, D.C., and he said at the scholarly conferences, the participants are saying, have you seen the Taylorville folk art? And I was the last to know. You know, that is such a thrill. He said, yes, you must see the Taylorville folk art. I think it's because by the people, for the people.
Now, you mentioned the gumballs, and here we have a series of statues. One is Lincoln and Mary, I believe.
Yes.
And then here we have
some children waving to them. And this was when our garden walks focused on actual weddings. We put on two weddings. And so Lincoln and Mary are going to a wedding. And they're all dressed up, and Mary has her parasol. And these young children that are waving to them. And did you notice in this buggy made of sweet gum balls, the handle? And there's a doll inside, also sweet gum balls. And inside this covered wagon, which is a toy of the little boy, we see an owl. And then perched on the covered wagon is the state bird, the cardinal.
Now, you're also using, I believe, in addition to the gumballs, a few pine cones. I see some, I believe, burlap. But everything has been glued or stuck. How do you get gumballs to stay together? I know they're sticky, but I've never seen a gumball take this shape before.
That is a very good question. And you're very perceptive, and the answer to that is liquid nails. he uses 1x2s to provide a support for each figure, and then he kind of puts in, he doesn't stuff it totally full, it's not solid, but he does put in inner layers of gumballs and then the outer layer, and then it's held together then with liquid nails, and then everything is painted. So that's his secret. And you know what? We really believe he's the only person in the world who is doing this.
The statues are amazing, and this one, as you said, really is beyond belief. This is basically a full-size horse. Well, perhaps slightly young, but it's nearly full-size, the whole figure.
Yes, and the mane is straw that Mr. Matheny has painted. The bridle is made out of a row of sweet gum balls. There are actual horseshoes on the hooves, and I'd like to show you something over here. We're going to pass the stovepipe hat. And look at the saddlebag with a movable top to it. And this one has a movable top as well.
So it's actually operational almost.
It's operational, it is. And it's on wheels. And someone has said that, you know, to stir up even more interest in this exhibit, we should have one of our volunteers, or maybe myself, you know, whoever, pull this down 6th Street.
It could be a parade component,
yes.
Surely.
And say, come to 210 South 6th and see the Taylorville Folk Art.
That was Carol Alexander of the Taylorville Tourism Council. She talked with Jiffy Johnson during the opening of the Abraham Lincoln Library and Museum in Springfield. This is Sidetrack. Well, April showers can bring more than May flowers. A rainy spring mixed with some hot weather can produce another, often more coveted form of wildlife, morel mushrooms. Morels can be found just about anywhere in the world. However, experts say the Midwest is one of the best places to go mushroom hunting. Nick Wilkins tells us morel lovers traverse wooded areas with great caution to try and find a most prized fungus.
When looking for morels in the woods, hunters move very slowly to avoid stepping on any mushrooms. They overturn dead trees and carefully pick through dead undergrowth. WIU student Aaron Stevenson is among those who hunt. He says he's been mushroom hunting since he was a kid.
Well, I can remember as a kid, Dad taking me out behind the house and walking through the woods, and it was how we bonded. And it was kind of like nature's game of hide and seek, and it always was fun for me to go, and I got excited when I would find morels.
Stevenson says ever since then, he tries to go mushroom hunting every spring. He says some springs are better than others, but he remembers one mushroom hunt 2 years ago that was particularly successful.
So we walk up to this fence row, and as we're getting up there, we're picking mushrooms along the way, and just when you got to the fence, you'd look over, and in the grass, all you saw was mushroom tops.
Stevenson says he and his fellow hunter picked about 5 pounds that day. And they would have gotten more, but they ran out of ways to carry them. Morel hunters say they enjoy the mushrooms because they are such a rarity. Some grocery stores carry them, but usually at a steep price. Some mushroom hunters carry their haul in mesh bags, so spores will be dropped for next year's hunt. Other mushroom enthusiasts even try to grow their own morels. WIU professor and mycologist Bob Gessner says morels can be commercially produced.
A master's student at San Francisco State worked out how to do it for his master's thesis. And the patent was sold to a group in Michigan Institute of Technology, and they patent the process.
Gessner says one way morels are different from other mushrooms is their spores are contained in a sac instead of on a club. He also says the rough surface on the cap of the mushroom plays a role in reproduction.
And if you look at a morel closely, it's made up of a series of ridges and sort of pits. The pits, these sort of indentations, are the surfaces where the spores are produced, and those are just covered with sort of finger-like structures that contain, each of which contains 8 spores.
After the hunt, it's time to eat. Many people slice morels in half and soak them in salt water to sanitize them. After that, it's up to the chef. At this particular mushroom feast, the preferred method is to batter the morels in flour and fry them in butter. A few of those present were eating morels for the first time.
I would have to compare them to, like, something fried, obviously, because they were fried. We'll go with fried zucchinis. Yeah. They're definitely way better.
It's like deep fried heaven.
Deep fried heaven, huh?
It's one of the best things I've ever had before.
Would you want to compare them to any other food you've ate?
It tastes like calamari, but the flavor is more Plentiful.
Morel mushroom hunting is such an early spring passion that hunters from all over the country post pictures and messages about their findings on morel websites. There are even morel festivals for the most fervent mushroom hunters. From the forest floor to the frying pan, morel mushrooms are both a springtime activity and delicacy for those willing to go on the hunt. I'm Nick Wilkins, reporting.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Bizarre beasts, ancient oddities, and spooky cemeteries. Those are just a few of the curious stories in Troy Taylor's new book, Weird Illinois, published by Barnes & Noble. He spoke with Carvitha Cardoza in Springfield about his experiences researching and writing the book.
You've spent more than two decades researching this book, and this is your 35th published book about legends and myths and ghosts and things like that. Where did this fascination with things that go bump in the night come from?
Actually, it's been a lifelong interest for me. I usually tell people that everybody, it seems, has an interest in ghosts, but most people just outgrow it about age 12, but I just never did. So, you know, I guess I'm still a 12-year-old boy at heart, and I've always been fascinated with this kind of stuff, ghost stories and legends and just very unusual people, places, and things, really. This book was kind of a breath of fresh air for me because I usually write strictly on ghosts and history, and this was a way to combine a lot of history, a few ghosts, and then a lot of really different things that I don't normally get to write about. Just trying to track things down, you know, whether there really were, you know, white squirrels in Olney, or, you know, whether people really rub Abraham Lincoln's nose for good luck at the tomb and that kind of thing. So it was a lot of fun.
After reading Weird Illinois and the haunted Hell Hollow in Decatur and the Mad Gasser in Mattoon and the Murfreesboro Mud Monster, you know, suddenly these seemingly innocuous towns don't quite seem that way anymore.
The interesting thing about that is even people who live in the towns a lot of times don't realize what a strange past their town has. I did a lecture actually earlier this year in Mattoon, Illinois at the college, and I asked for a show of hands over, we're talking about several hundred people, how many had ever heard of the Mad Gasser of Mattoon? Probably not more than a couple of dozen people raised their hands. So it's interesting for me now to go and look at a map or to go to some of these places and know that there's kind of a lot of secrets in a lot of little and large towns that people just aren't aware of.
Your book really covers the weird gamut. You've got the 170-foot-tall catsup bottle water tower. You've got the ghosts of St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago, the old slave house on Hickory Hill in southern Illinois. Which three stories did you have the most fun researching?
There was a place called Vishnu Springs up in kind of northwestern Illinois that was a kind of a little religious utopian community. This guy had founded literally around a spring that supposedly had healing qualities, and he built a literal town. And I mean, this is in the middle of nowhere, in a valley, in the woods, and he attracted several hundred people. They built houses, stores, a saloon, an amusement park, all kinds of things. And eventually the whole thing crumbled, mostly because of the founder's sexual proclivities, really, kind of what killed the community. But it was an interesting place to research because I got a chance to go visit the place. And it's, you know, completely abandoned. Most of the buildings are gone except for this grand old hotel that just sits out in the middle of the woods. And that was, it's very eerie and spooky, and that was a lot of fun to look into. The Mad Gasser of Mattoon, which we've already mentioned, was something else that was a lot of fun because it's one of those things that nobody really can say one way or the other if it really happened, whether it really mass hysteria or was something really unusual going on in this town. I mean, I tend to lean toward the idea that there was some nut run, you know, not a spaceman or, you know, a government conspiracy, but some nut running around spraying gas in people's windows, and then they went out of control. You know, people just went crazy over it. And I think that was an interesting story, and that was a lot of fun. Probably one of the most entertaining places, and the one that I get a lot of questions about is the two-story outhouse in Gays, Illinois. I guess my thing about it is that, you know, I always ask the question, you know, who in their right mind would want to use the downstairs of a two-story outhouse, you know, especially if you're in the downstairs and you hear footsteps above your head. But the funny thing about this outhouse was actually attached to an old hotel years ago, and the hotel is gone, but the outhouse is still there. And there's actually a secret method to this outhouse. There was like a secret wall where obviously nothing was going to, you know, you get the idea, from upstairs to downstairs. But it's probably one of the more entertaining stories, and it was a lot of fun to look into, and people ask about it all. All you have to do is mention two-story outhouse, people just go crazy. They want to know what you're talking about. So, yeah, that was one that I really enjoyed.
What was the criteria you used to decide, well, what is weird and what isn't?
For me, weird was just something really unusual. It didn't have to be a ghost story. It didn't have to be, you know, anything really demented or anything. It just had to be unusual or strange or different, you know, something that I felt like that people would be interested in. My criteria was much looser than my publisher's criteria. If they had put everything into the book that I had given them, it would have been about like four times the size, and no one could have afforded to buy it. It had been so expensive. I mean, I would get calls from the editor, and they'd say, you know, Troy, you're breaking our heart, but you got to stop sending us this stuff. I think what they did was they really just tried to pick the cream of the crop.
My favorite story in the book, it's someone who collects partially eaten celebrity sandwiches, and I thought, that was definitely peculiar. What was your favorite weird Illinois story?
The best story, one of my favorite stories of all time, is the story of Resurrection Mary on Chicago's South Side. She's the hitchhiking ghost who died back in the 20s after a winter dance, died on her way home, and has been hitching rides on Archer Avenue ever since. It's one of those stories that everybody's heard a story like it. Everybody's heard a vanishing hitchhiker story of one type or another, but most of those stories are kind of a friend of a friend story that happened a long time ago at a place far away. And what makes Resurrection Mary's story different is that it's a real place, a real time. There are dates involved. There are real people involved. I mean, real life people who would vouch for the fact that they, you know, encountered something unusual or actually picked her up. And it's a little different. Just something about it has always appealed to me. I don't know if it's the unsolved aspect of it, the unexplained aspect of it, or if it's just the fact that I'm just like a hopeless romantic at heart, and I just love this story about this blonde that, you know, hitches rides. I don't know. I have no idea. That story has always been one of my favorites, and I was really happy when I got the book and found that the editors had put it as the very first story in the ghost story section. So, yeah, I was very happy about that.
That was Troy Taylor, author of Weird Illinois. He spoke with Carvitha Cardoza in Springfield. Still to come on the program, we hear a commentary from engineer Bill Hammack, and we hear from one of the few practitioners of a form of classical Indian music, improvised vocal percussion. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Tibetan monks visited the Western Illinois University campus for 3 days recently to share their ancient art forms and to promote world peace and healing. Mark Nelson attended the creation and destruction of a mandala sand painting and filed this report.
Low, penetrating chants rolled from a CD player as Tibetan monks in wine-colored robes hovered intently over a slowly evolving mandala. The monks leaned on folded cushions, their hands carefully rasping colored sand from rigid metal funnels, or shakpur. The pigmented grains poured steadily from the shakpur, sometimes mounding in delicate ridges or blending almost imperceptibly in a graded swath of blue or yellow. A handout supplied by the monks says sand painting has its origins in the 20,000-year-old tantric roots of Buddhist India. Mandala is a Sanskrit word meaning sacred cosmogram, or world in harmony. On one level, these paintings represent the earth inhabited by enlightened beings. Mandalas feature geometric shapes and ancient sacred symbols. One of the monks was Chupin Choseng, who's from the Drepung Losling Monastery.
Our first objective is to promote peace, healing in the world, by means of the sacred art. That's what we are doing.
Choseng said the monks from his monastery have been asked to construct mandalas at sites all over the world, including the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and Ground Zero in New York City. As the monks worked, small, hushed groups of students, staff, and faculty gathered. Christiane Morel feels the university was privileged to witness such a beautiful and ancient art form.
It's absolutely amazing. I can't believe it. It's just stunning. People told me, go see this. It's amazing. And it really is. Mm-hmm. The colors, and I can't believe all the intricate work they're doing. And just what they're doing is beautiful. The idea of it all. It's great that they're here. Western's really lucky.
New York poet Malcolm Randall has been working as a monk's road manager for the past year. Randall says many of the monks were forced to flee their homeland after the 1959 Chinese occupation of Tibet.
Since then, 1.6 million people have died as a result of that occupation. And it's against the law for them to learn their language or learn to write their language or read or study their beliefs and philosophies, which is, in effect, genocide.
Despite this, the monks bear no hatred toward the Chinese.
They believe that people who oppress you and treat you poorly should be cherished most of all, because it's very easy to practice loving kindness to people who are nice to you, and not many people will be rude to you to your face. And so those people give you the opportunity to put your practice in full existence.
When the sand painting was completed, the monks consecrated the work with prayers and chants. They then ceremoniously destroyed the mandala to symbolize the impermanence of all that exists. A portion of the swept sand was distributed to the audience for personal healing and well-being. The remaining sand was carried to the Lemoyne River and cast into the flowing water. The monk Chupin Choseng says rivers play an important role in the mandala process.
Through the river, and it will at last going to reach into the oceans, you know. In the ocean, there are so many living beings. Mm-hmm. So all of them will receive that healing energy. After that, it comes down in the form of precipitations, snowfall or rainfall. So that's why, you know, so it's kind of we are sharing that kind of blessing, healing energy throughout the world.
Christy Steelman of WIU's Bureau of Cultural Affairs says the monks' visit elicited positive feedback from the student body.
Yeah, we've had great student reaction. I'm so pleased that while we always want more and more students to be involved, the ones that were involved had a very moving experience.
The monks' tour will eventually take them through Canada. Then they will head home to their monastery in southern India. They have not been home for 18 months. Mark Nelson reporting.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Bill Hammack has joined the iPod generation. Unlike the youth of America, Bill says his iPod is filled mostly with public radio and the occasional Ella Fitzgerald tune.
At first I found it great. I mean, no moving parts, just this tiny sliver of a thing, so anytime I exercise I can listen on demand to public radio. Then one day it all stopped. You see, I purchased some of the public radio shows, and for some reason the iPod software stopped downloading it. Turns out that the permissions got goofed up. iPod thought I was illegally downloading them, which I wasn't. But it got me to thinking, is it really a fantastic thing to have all this intellectual property tied up electronically? Sure, it seems convenient, but what's the downside? Well, the courts have dealt with this in the past. When VCRs first arrived on the scene, Hollywood studios tried to curtail their use by suing the electronics giant Sony, a major manufacturer. The Supreme Court wisely held that individuals had the right to use VCRs to make complete copies of television shows for personal use. Technological advances, though, have made this issue even more acute. If you had a VCR tape of a show, you could make copies, but they were never as good as the original, and further duplication of that copy made even worse copies. Now, of course, the digital revolution has erased the difference. A computer can make a copy identical to the original, plus a billion more. This, of course, has the entertainment industry terrified, especially when combined with the Internet, which provides unlimited distribution of these digital copies. While I understand the fears of the entertainment industry, I hope the courts and legislators continue to resist restricting too much our ability to copy files. When everything turns into electronic form, we run the risk that every embodiment of thought or imagination may be subjected to some kind of commercial control. For example, as books become electronic, readers may lose the rights they've had since Gutenberg's time. The publishers of an electronic book can specify whether you can read the book all at once or only in parts, and they can decide whether you read it once or 100 times. So the risk is this: the literary and intellectual canon of the coming century may be locked into a digital vault accessible only to a few. As the courts and Congress regulate digital copying, I think they should keep in mind an aphorism from T.S. Eliot about literary creativity. "Good poets borrow," he said. "Great poets steal."
Bill Hammack teaches chemical engineering at the University of Illinois. His essays on engineering and life can be found on the web at engineerguy.com. You're listening to Sidetrack. Some of today's sports writers and broadcasters make it sound like baseball fans are getting out of control with a handful of player-fan confrontations the past couple of seasons. But as baseball historian and author Richard Pete Peterson tells us, the relationship between today's players and fans could be considered placid compared to their counterparts of the early 20th century.
A few weeks ago, a Boston Red Sox fan created a baseball tempest when he reached over the short right field wall at Fenway Park for a baseball and hit Yankee outfielder Gary Sheffield in the face. Sheffield, after fielding the ball, took his own swipe at the Red Sox fan, but fortunately swung and missed. No one was hurt in the incident, but sport writers declared that today's rowdy fans were becoming a threat to the game. The truth is that baseball has always been rowdy, and its fans have always had a love-hate relationship with ballplayers. Some of the game's greatest players have had confrontations with fans, and fans, in turn, have disrupted some of baseball's most important games. It should surprise no one that Ty Cobb, the ballplayer everybody loved to hate, had his own share of run-ins with fans. But Cobb outdid himself in New York on May 15, 1912, when he went into the stands and assaulted a fan who had been shouting insults at him. As Cobb knocked his tormentor to the ground and began stomping him with his spikes, someone yelled that the fan was handicapped and had only one hand. Cobb, in a rage, shouted back, "I don't care if he doesn't have any feet," and continued to throttle the fan until a policeman came to the rescue. Unlike Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth became one of the most lovable characters in baseball, but even the Babe had his share of altercations with umpires and fans. After being suspended for the first 6 weeks of the 1922 season for going on a banned barnstorming tour, Ruth struggled to get back into playing shape. On a hot, muggy afternoon in late May, an overweight, slumping, and frustrated Ruth was tossed out of a game when he threw dirt into the face of an umpire. As Ruth returned to the dugout, New York fans booed and hissed until Ruth stopped and took a deep, mocking bow. When a fan shouted, "You big bum, why don't you play ball?" Ruth leaped into the stands and chased after him. Unable to get his hands on the fan, Ruth climbed on top of the dugout and shouted at the crowd, "Come on down and fight," Anyone who wants to fight, come on down to the field. You're all alike. You're all yellow. Baseball fans did come down to the field before the third game of the 1903 World Series between Boston and Pittsburgh and nearly caused a forfeit. Because it was the first modern World Series ever played, Boston fans were so excited that those who couldn't get a ticket crashed the gates. As the crowd swelled, thousands of fans broke through the restraining ropes and covered the playing surface except for the dirt infield. When police had trouble beating back the crowd with their batons, they were joined by Pittsburgh and Boston players who used their bats to help out. After the fans were pushed back far enough into the outfield, the game was played, but only after the police stormed into the crowd to retrieve second base, which had been stolen by a souvenir-seeking fan. In the seventh game of the 1934 World Series, played between the Detroit Tigers and the Gashaus Gang St. Louis Cardinals, Detroit fans didn't come onto the field, but it did force the Commissioner of Baseball to remove a Cardinal player from the game. In the sixth inning, with St. Louis leading 7-0 in what had been a bitterly fought World Series, the Cards' Ducky Medwick enraged Detroit fans by sliding hard into third base and nearly spiking Tigers third baseman Marv Owen. When Medwick trotted out to left field after the inning was over, Detroit fans showered him with everything from apples, tomatoes, and oranges to empty bottles and pieces of metal. At first, Medwick tried to make fun of the barrage by throwing apples back and forth with third baseman Pepper Martin, but his action only instigated another barrage from the fans. Finally, Commissioner Landis, after conferring with the umpires, ordered Medwick removed from the game. The Cardinals went on to win the game 11-0 and the World Series title, but they did it without the banished Medwick. The near riot of fans in the 1903 and 1934 World Series and the ill-tempered acts of Ruth and Cobb are merely a few illustrations of baseball's rowdy history, but they do serve to show that baseball is quite capable of surviving the worst behavior of its fans and players. Baseball has its dark, stormy days, but it doesn't mean the sky is falling.
That was Richard Pete Peterson, editor for the Southern Illinois University Press Writing Baseball Series and author of Extra Innings, Writing on Baseball. This is Sidetrack. Drama between Western Illinois University theater students recently reached violent levels. Some actors drew swords while others faced off in hand-to-hand combat. Fortunately, a leading instructor in the stunt industry was on hand to make sure no one got hurt. Nathan Locke has the story.
Two students angrily circle each other. Tempers rise with violent intent. They both draw a sword and fight. The vicious fight to the death is actually part of a skills proficiency test in stage combat, held at Western. Stage combat is any rehearsed physical violence used in a theatrical performance. Most of the time, this involves actors performing a fight during a pivotal scene of a play. Just like in film, the fights are choreographed to demonstrate a dazzling display of skill. Graduate theater student Russ Brown believes stage fights involve more than just a display of action or violence.
We're about the performance, so it's about, you know, combat for production, making it safe, making it dramatically effective, making it fit the storyline.
Safety during stage fights is of great concern. Untrained actors risk causing serious injury to themselves or others during fight scenes. To educate performers on combat safety, David Boucher founded the Society of American Fight Directors in 1977. The SAFD provides training in safe and effective stage combat for film and theater. Boucher says, before the existence of SAFD, people in American theater ignored the need for safety in stage combat.
if you just are not aware of what can be done with a sword or what shouldn't be done with a sword, quite by accident, you could severely hurt somebody. There have been people who've been killed on stage in front of a live audience with a sword being run through their bosom because they brought some fencing coach in who does modern fencing, which has nothing to do with classical swordplay, and somebody has made a mistake and someone has literally been impaled on the end of a sword.
Boucher's workshop at Western demonstrated to theater students some basic concepts of stage combat used in film. Senior theater student Benjamin Hale says Boucher covered some key techniques.
He taught us about the different angles that you have to use and the perspective that's easily used in film so that when they throw a punch or they swing a chair, the target is actually 4 feet away from them. But because of the forced perspective of the single camera, it looks like they hit them.
Boucher is also the founder of the United Stuntmen's Association and consults at an international stunt school in Seattle. He's enjoyed a 30-year professional career as stunt performer and instructor for stage and film. The safety principles Boucher started in the theater have transferred to his work in movies. Boucher says the work of a stuntman is challenging.
Being crazy does not make a stuntman. Being somebody who's a kamikaze, as we call them, does not make a stuntman. Anybody who's willing to risk life and limb is not a true stuntman. A stuntman takes precautions, and they are calculated precautions.
Boucher also says he has never broken a bone as a stuntman. Nathan Locke reporting.
You're dead.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. There are only 4 practitioners of an ancient Indian music form left, though there are a few students as well. Charlie Schlenker visits with a master of improvised vocal percussion.
Mr. H. Ramakrishnan wears a number of very large hats. He is a former newscaster and television news director in Madras. He is a lawyer for the High Court of Madras, a polio survivor and father of 4, and he is a practitioner of the vanishing art form of Konakol, a tradition of mouth music, improvised percussion. It's been described by some as a kind of South Indian scat music. Would you accept that comparison to American jazz?
Yes, to some extent.
How does it differ?
It's different because it has more of variations. For example, you see, in the Western jazz, this is how they play the jazz rhythm. When we do it in Konakol, tata chuttu tata dimmi, though we start it in the same scale, tata chuttu tata dimmi, tata chuttu tata dimmi, so this is how the variations are more. There is more of arithmetic and mathematics in our rhythmic patterns.
Tell us a little bit about how you learned Konakol and what it's all about.
You see, I started learning mridangam when I was 8 under a master.
And mridangam is the drum, right?
Mridangam is the drum. The difference between a Western drum and the mridangam is mridangam has a pitch and it has to be adjusted to the pitch of the performer, either vocalist or the instrumentalist. So, but ganjira, the one which I played now, this has no pitch. This can be played for any pitch. It has been played for any pitch. And then later on, I developed a liking for Konakol. For example, when in the mridangam, you call this na dim din, na na dim din, like that. But in the Konakol, we say ta dim din na ta ta din din na ta dim ta dim ta dim ta ta chulta ta dim ta ta chulta ta ta dim ta ta chulta tarikada karta ta chulta. So like that, even the vocal rhythmic patterns are different, though they are akin to the mridangam, ganjira, ghatam. Ghatam is the earthen instrument, you know, made of mud.
Clay?
Clay, yeah.
Okay. It's said that konakol was originally used thousands of years ago to orally teach music because Indian musicians did not use written notations. Is that changed at all?
Yes, to some extent. Now, you see, formerly there used to be no music concert without konakol. There was a period of time. But now it is very rarely that you see a konakol artist on the dais for a music performance.
Why is that?
The reason being that maybe the later konakol artists, they perhaps tended to dominate and they suppressed the vocalist or the instrumentalist. So they decided, no, we won't have him anymore. That must have been the reason. Because the konakols should be subservient to the other percussion instruments on the dais. But it adds to the richness of the music.
It's not just the rhythm, it's lyrics as well. Could you give us a little more of a sample there?
Yes, lyric. You know, in India, in Indian tradition, we believe that every word has a power. Every word, every syllable has some power. We consider it as a spiritual power. So whenever we recite these words, they have a power behind them. So you can't change it at random. For example, taka chutta taka dimmi, taka chutta taka dimmi, tati kitta tom, tati kitta tom, tati kitta tom, ta, tati kinna tom. That has a kind of a spiritual meaning. Though you can say that it is just five syllables, tati kinna tom. So, taka chutu, taka chutu, taka chutu, taka chutu, it is 16. So, you miss one and say, tati kutatun, tati kutatun, tati kutatun, ta.
And what's the original meaning, and then how does that change the meaning when you skip
the I won't say it has any meaning in the mundane world. For example, for you, the most important word in the world will be Charlie. Charlie. Even in a congregation of 1,000, when somebody says Charlie, definitely you will look at them. You will tend to look at them. So each word has a meaning to each individual.
So it's a way to focus attention in the audience.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How useful would the rhythmic structures in konakol be to, say, rap musicians in the U.S.?
Yes, I think it will be a wonderful thing if the rap musicians of the United States have konakol as their accompaniment, because it will go very well together. The both will go together. And I tell you, the konakol has the unique, capacity to adjust to any kind of rhythm, any kind of music, that I don't think any other rhythmic pattern in the world has got that much of capacity and vastness.
Mr. H. Ramakrishnan has received awards for cultural preservation in Tamil Nadu State, India. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.